I'd like to wish you all the warmest welcome to this launch of yet another report from EBA. I'm glad to see that so many of you are here. We have a great mix of participants. I recognize a lot of people from civil society. There is CEDA, there is the Foreign Ministry, research, and I think it's great that we can create this opportunity for our different part of society to actually meet and discuss this issue. So, warmest welcome to everyone. We are here today to launch the report, Rethinking Civil Society and Support for Democratization. My name is Julia Schalk, and I'm a member of the expert group, for development aid studies. I'm sorry, I was reading my title in another context and I got confused. I'm sorry. Apart from that, being a member of the expert group, I'm also a senior policy advisor at RFSU that I was aiming at. And the expert group for aid studies is a government committee with the task of independently analyzing and evaluating Swedish development cooperation. And we do this primarily by commissioning studies conducted by prominent scholars, such as Richard here today, and other practitioners from the field of development cooperation. And today, I have the honor of welcoming Professor Richard Young, the author of this new report that we're launching here today. And if you haven't already got a copy, please do take one on the table outside when you go out. It will also be, of course, available on the website. So why the theme of this report? Obviously, democracy and human rights is one of the main priorities for development cooperation. And annually, more than 5 billion kroners is set aside to strengthen democracy and human rights in different countries. And a major part of this support is channeled to or through civil society. But of course, CEDA also channels support in other sectors through and to civil society. And given the priority within Swedish development cooperation, we thought it would be interesting to issue a report that would look at the current trends of a changing civil society, but also the environment that civil society is working within. But then also, how should donors react to these changes that we see? And we'll here today to discuss that further. Richard will, of course, present his report, and then we will have other perspectives discussed based on that report from other research, civil society itself, and, of course, decision makers from the ministry, CEDA, and civil society. So, as I said, I will do my best to ensure that we have a very fruitful discussion, but that we also finish at 11 as promised. So, without taking too much time then, I'd like to welcome Professor Richard Young, the author of this report, Rethinking Civil Society and Support for Democracy. And Richard is a lead expert on international relations and democracy support, and he's a senior associate at Carnegie Europe and professor at the University of Warwick. Please.
Thank you very much. Thank you to everyone for coming this morning. Thank you to Emma and Julia for coordinating the work of the expert group and for inviting me to offer my thoughts on this very important topic of rethinking civil society support, whether one does need to rethink civil society support, and if so, in what ways. Obviously, the issue of civil society support is a very old and familiar topic. It's the subject of dozens and dozens of different reports, many familiar sets of recommendations that tend to be repeated on a fairly regular basis. Donors continually commit themselves to enhancing their support for civil society organizations around the world, and hardly need reminding that this has to be a vital aspect of all areas of development support. What I was asked to do in this report was something slightly different. That was to stand back from the immediate level of how one runs more effective projects at a micro level and think about the more overarching or macro level changes that are underway to civil society at a global level, and to examine some of the debates that have emerged over the last 5 to 7 years over whether that we are really witnessing a new type of civil society emerging, what implications this has for donors, for the health of democratic systems, democratic activism across the world, and how donors should respond to some of these changes. The report looks at one very specific part of civil society support, and that is civil society support that is directly relevant to democracy building. Obviously, as Julie was saying, civil society support is a huge universe that touches upon many different elements of development support. In this report, we're concerned specifically with the role of civil society support within donors' declared aims to support democracy and human rights more effectively across the world. Clearly, there is a general feeling that something is happening to civil society across the globe. Over the last 5 years, we have seen historically high levels of protest, not just in one region, but across the globe. This has bred a feeling that something structural is afoot in the way that civil society is changing across the world. The general feeling is also that the explosion of civic protests across the world is integrally linked to the greater activity of new types of social movements that are beginning to fundamentally change the basic way in which civil society is organized. And as you all know, a lot of talk about civic activism therefore being more fluid, more agile, and being organized, as I say, in fundamentally different ways. So greater activity and greater fluidity in civil society. This opens up many new opportunities, but it also carries with it many risks. The argument I would make is that these changes are significant. At the same time, a lot of what has been said about the changes sometimes overstates or simplifies the kind of changes that are underway in civil society. So we do need a very measured and nuanced understanding of how civil society is changing, how it is not changing, elements of continuity as well as change, in order for donors to adjust at the right kind of level, in order for them to be able to calibrate the right kind of responses to the changes we are seeing. So my argument will be that donors do need to adjust. They don't need to over-adjust. Not everything needs changing. The kinds of trends we've seen in the last 5 years do not change all aspects of civil society support, as some people have a tendency to argue. There are positive opportunities. There are also negative risks. I will explain to you how the flip side of some of the positive elements of the new civic activism is a greater determination and cleverness on the part of many non-democratic regimes to restrict the space for civil society activity. And that is something also that donors need to more systematically begin to address. And wrapping up from all that, I'll try to map the structural changes we are seeing to global civil society to 5 policy suggestions that donors might usefully think about. So, positives and negatives. I say, I think my kind of one line conclusion from all this would be that trends differ across countries, across regions, and there's no one singular trend or right response in looking at the way that civil society is changing. Civil society is changing in different ways in different countries and different regions. I think that's an important conclusion to bear in mind. Okay, the report makes an effort, very briefly, to try to conceptualize the way that civil society is changing. This has bred a lot of debate over the last 5 years. There are very, very serious divergences between analysts who follow civil society trends about how civil society is changing, whether it's changing or not, and about whether these trends are positive or negative. If we look at some of the facts, many initiatives and databases have traced the fact that we do see at the moment an historically high level of protest intensity. The intensity of protests over the last 5 years does look to be something different. It stands at a higher level than it has been for many, many decades. Various initiatives have charted reasonably significantly sized protests have occurred in over 70 states in recent years. The protests have multiplied. They're also very different kinds. Very different kinds. As you all know, some of protests are about austerity, some are about repression, some of them are about very specific policy issues, development issues, other local community issues. So they are very diverse sets of protests, but at the same time we see a clustering of these protests in a trend that represents, as I say, an historically high level of civic protest. So there is great diversity there. But in some manner, there is something common underlying these different types of protests that has led to this clustering that we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years. So protesting over 70 states, some of these protests have been of a much larger scale than we've seen for many, many decades. In countries like Brazil, India, Turkey, protests involving well over a million people sometimes. Again, this seems to be something of a new change. Also, these are not protests that have occurred in only one or two regions, as perhaps we've seen at other moments in history. As I say, great diversity, but we've seen protests in all regions across the globe, in authoritarian states, in democratic states. So there seems, again, something of a generalizable nature seems to be happening that isn't specific to any particular region's challenges or domestic specificities. And a significant factor here is that this means that a lot of this protest, most of this protest, is very firmly rooted in national political debate. It takes place around nationally focused interests and grievances, complaints. Again, people talk about this being a change from the kind of globally oriented activism we were seeing 10 or 15 years ago. So many people talk about a gradual shift from civic activity based on very generic global public goods towards concerns much more rooted in national specificities, in national political debate, and much more of a locally flavoured tone and flavour to the civic protests. Some protests are very radical, very disruptive, much more kind of far-reaching in the extent to which they seek to challenge the status quo. Other protests are less radical. So we see a spectrum in terms of just how ambitious and far-reaching these protests have been. And of course, a big focus of debate over the last 4 or 5 years is the general view that what we're seeing is not just greater quantity of protests, but also protests of a qualitatively different nature, that civic groups have adopted new kinds of tactics. They've gone through a process of learning over a generation and a half now and have come to adopt much more effective tactics. So they're much more agile and show a much greater ability in raising the profile of their protests, making sure protests are larger, longer lasting, focusing in on realizable objectives. And again, all this has generated a greater momentum, it is argued, to civic protests. So all this new civic activity that appears to be occurring is linked to a basic foundational change, it is generally thought. And that is the fact that social movements, you all know, movements generally thought to be organized on a looser basis than traditional NGOs, less hierarchical, often more fluid both in their tactics and their substantive aims. Okay, so this is an organizational change, but it's also a change in terms of how organizations define their end goals, how they define their essential identities. All these have represented very significant changes and again fed into and acted as a kind of driving cause of this expansion of global civic activity. Tentatively, I think one can offer some kind of typology of these protests. I say they're of very different natures. I think one risk at the moment is many people talk about the new global civil society, the new age of protest, as if it were a monolithic whole. In fact, if you begin to break down and look in detail at the protests, they're very, very different. They're motivated by different kinds of concerns and often organized in different ways. I mean, this is tentative. I think the different kinds of protests and concerns sometimes overlap with each other. But I think in general, we can distinguish four different types of protests that have occurred over the last decade. Some are very focused on anti-austerity measures. Some are pro-democracy protests operating in authoritarian contexts. Some mix this concern with systemic level change and more micro level concerns. That they are essentially protests organized around very specific policy concerns, but they have to do with a more broadly cast concern with the decline of democratic quality. So these are kind of protests that occur in countries that are nominally or formally democratic or have a significant degree of democracy, but where citizens are increasingly concerned about a declining quality of democracy. So these tend to be the countries that exist at the kind of borderline between authoritarian and democratic regimes. And then there are other protests organized around very specific policy questions, the price of transport, access to food, local development issues. So as I say, I think we need to distinguish those different types of protests. I think they have different implications for donors. Donors need to address these different types of protests in different ways. As I say, these are not absolute categories. I think in any one protest, you can probably see dimensions of systemic level concerns and local concerns. The issue is the balance between the big macro concerns and the more specific policy concerns. So the general implication of this is that analysts talk about a new form of active citizenship. So those who argue that this really is a very significant trend we are seeing argue that this is actually not just about one or two specific policy questions. It's not just about austerity or about anti-globalization or about a particular development issue. It heralds the emergence of a new kind of active citizenship. So although the protests are very different, all the surveying shows, there is one factor that links them all together, that provides a common thread, and that is that citizens everywhere under very different types of political regimes feel that they lack effective voice. They lack effective voice. Socially, economically, politically, as I say, whether under democracies, quasi-democracies, or fully authoritarian regimes, somehow governments seem to be less responsive and less able to offer meaningful policy alternatives than people perceived to be the case a decade ago. And I say all this adds up to the point I already mentioned. There's a general feeling that this is not just a question of protest, but the supplanting of new types of protests, new types of citizenship, a more participative form of citizenship, displacing some of the more traditionally professionalized NGOs, and perhaps even more significantly, some of the more traditional channels of representative democracy. So many people say we really see something fundamental that is taking place that goes well beyond the significance of one or two individual protests. So all that is significant. It is clearly significant, and these are the kind of trends that we bring out in the report and argue that they do need some form of adjustment on the part of donors. At the same time, I would argue that some degree of nuance and measure is required. I think there is a tendency sometimes perhaps to overstate just how significant all this new civic activism is and the degree to which it really does represent a change. So I think if one looks at a broader historical period, we can see that what we've seen in the last 5 years is not completely new. It's not completely new. There have been other periods where there has been a peak of civic protest and democracy has not collapsed. I mean, the global system has not collapsed. Social movements have been around for 15, 20 years, been very active for 15 or 20 years. So not completely new. If anything, what we're seeing is the end of a period of long gestation, these kind of the emergence of social movements, of new types of more fluid civic activism have been in the pipeline for a long time. And they've learned new tactics, they've learned from mistakes, and that is perhaps why we're seeing a kind of peak of activity at the moment. But that it contrary to a lot of comment that one sees about the eruption of entirely frustrated new global citizenry, what we're seeing is not entirely new. It is happening in all regions of the world. But at the same time, we need to bear in mind that there are many countries where it's not happening. And even in countries where it is happening, often it still involves a relatively small proportion of the population. So again, contrary to suggestions that we're seeing a massive global uprising against governments, against the global economic system. Yes, the level of activity is very significant, but it should not be overstated. There are many countries around the world where civic activists are still find it impossible to organize, where conditions are too restrictive, where the costs of doing so are seen as being prohibitive. So I don't think we are yet seeing a completely widespread uprising against repressive forms of government. There are many places where citizens are still very, very cautious and where they still need to be motivated by any perceived benefits of political change. I think there's also a question mark over just how far this new civic activism is actually completely displacing traditional forms of activism. As you all know, the conventional wisdom is that today's civic activism is very anti-politics. It's very anti-politics. In some cases, this clearly is the case. It clearly is the case. I mean, groups have a very their identity is openly anti-traditional politics. But in other cases, it isn't. In other cases, it isn't. There are many cases where new types of social groups actually try to work with more traditional channels of political representation, where their aims are not so overwhelmingly radical. And what we're seeing is actually a very interesting build-up of new linkages and alliances between social movements, NGOs, unions, parties. And in a way, the interesting new politics we're seeing is the way that those alliances, at least in some countries, not in all cases, but at least in some countries, have taken shape over recent years. And I think it's in those cases where protests have broadened out and included both new and old types of civic activism that they've become most effective. Okay, so basic line, significant, but some of the common assumptions often made do tend to be rather overstated. The flip side of all this that we're seeing, governments react against the new civic activism. Governments are trying to restrict the scope of for these protests and new activism. And they're doing so not just in the most authoritarian regimes, but in a lot of semi-democratic regimes as well. Some of the best-known cases involve very harsh new laws against NGOs and other types of activism. But there are many more subtle techniques being used as well. So governments are becoming more restrictive, more repressive, but also cleverer and more subtle in the kinds of techniques that they use. I think the broader point here is that we need some kind of debate over what the essential functions, democracy-related functions of civil society are. I won't go into that now. We can perhaps pick that up in the debate. I think basically the message is we need a kind of proper... If we look at the way that civil society is changing, we need much more of a balance between civil society's role as holding executive power to account on the one hand, and on the other hand, acting as a kind of bridge-building function, a more kind of republican concept of building more effective state identities and more effective state institutions. That, I would argue, that's basically where, in a conceptual sense, where the challenge lies. Five recommendations to finish off. First of all, I think that the challenge is that donors need to do... They need to support more of the kind of liberal function of civil society and more of the republican concept at the same time. I think this is a difficult notion to pursue in a coherent way. In a way, donors need to do a lot more to engage with the more radical social movements that seek to act as a check on government power. But they also need to bear in mind that there needs to be a much stronger and organic link between social activism and traditional forms of political representation. Okay, so in a way, the donors need to move out of this kind of safe middle area where they've supported NGOs that basically function within fairly comfortable parameters. The more radical social movements need to be engaged with much more systematically, but there needs to be much more effort to build these kind of bridges and alliances that in many cases are incipient. The fact that many of the new forms of activism have not been effective has to do with the fact that the kind of linkages, the transmission belts between them and political parties in the state tends to break down. And that's why a lot of the new social activity doesn't translate into real tangible progress to the extent to which that might be of expected. Second, I think there needs to be more experimentation, much more vibrant debate in different regions around the world about different models of democracy. Again, I think this can be taken too far to some degree, but I think there is scope for donors being open and flexible to different kinds of social organization, different kinds of civic representation, and exploring how greater variation in democracy can be explored, but within the basic parameters of pluralist democracy. Third, I think there needs to be much more of a systematic strategy for dealing with the backlash against civil society support. I think this needs to be multifaceted. It's not just a question of reacting when civil society organizations are in danger from regimes. Donors need to get ahead of the curve. They need to work much more proactively through their foreign policy strategies to make sure that some of the very draconian new NGO laws are diverted in their earlier stages of development. I think the new, more difficult environment calls for greater transparency. Well, perhaps we can pick up some of these in the discussion, but I think there's a number of issues there that that governments need to look at. I think donors need to modify their approach to information communications technology. I think initially there was perhaps an over-optimism that this would radically change the form of pro-democracy civic activity. I think donors need to look much more at the enabling environment for ICT activity rather than simply focusing on capacity building for a select number of organizations that are based on ICT. And fifth and finally, I would argue that countries like Sweden and other Western donors can play a very, very valuable function in trying to get together all these different kinds of civic protests happening around the world and explore linkages, similarities and differences that are going on between different countries. And do that also in a way that involves some of the rising democracies like India, Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, that are increasingly showing interest in how they ride the wave of this new social activity in terms of civil society support programs within their own foreign policy strategies. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Richard. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but and you know, in time, that's as I said, my main promise here. But I was wondering, in terms of just, I don't know if you know, but in we are in the phase in Sweden here where the government is presenting soon a new, or this year at least, a new policy for civil society, or a new strategy. And what we know so far, and this might be discussed later also in the panel, is that this strategy is with the aim of strengthening long-term and trusting relationship and in their own right among civil society in developing countries and in Sweden. And it will focus on support for civil society capacity development and also contribute to a conducive environment. And I'm sorry, that's my own translation of ett gott samhällsklimat. But based on the findings that you've just presented and the policy recommendations, could you be a little, in, having this in mind, sort of, what would you recommend to have in mind when developing this strategy for a Swedish government?
Okay, it's a very broad-ranging question.
Just to allow you to be more concrete with your recommendations.
Okay, so I think on the issue of building relations of trust within particular developing countries, I would say one thing donors can do more on is to try and increase the levels of trust between these the more loosely organized social movements on the one hand and NGOs, parties, unions on the other hand. My experience is there's many countries around the world where the relationship between these different actors can often be quite fractious. As I was saying in the presentation, it differs from country to country, but there are at least some cases where the relations are quite hostile, and even actors that ostensibly are moving towards the same objectives can be quite competitive, and there's quite fierce rivalry between them. And instead of joining together their efforts in common endeavor, they actually end up almost undermining each other and being played off against each other by regimes. So I would say that's an area where donors can play this kind of bridge building.
Is that
role.
What you call a more republican approach, to understand?
That's, yes, exactly, yes. And then on the conducive environments, as I was saying, I think what's happening is as regimes become more restrictive and in a way more agile and proactive in trying to restrict the space for civil society support, donors themselves need to change tactics and realize that it cannot be as effective in the future to have simply an area of civil society support almost as a self-contained dimension of development support that is completely delinked from the broader set of diplomatic relations that exist with a particular country. These need to be much more joined together in order for us to have some kind of influential leverage over countries that at the moment know that they're able to more or less close off the channels for civil society support and not have their bilateral diplomatic or strategic relations in any way effective. As you all know, there's been a few very dramatic cases of this around the world in the last 5 years, Egypt, Russia, Venezuela. But it's not just these countries. It's not just these most authoritarian states. It's countries even with a reasonable degree of democracy that are introducing rules and laws that are more restrictive for civil society, and countries that, again, formally present themselves as being quite strong partners and allies of Western donors. So I would argue that donors need to look at civil society support much more broadly in the context of their overarching strategic relations with different countries. And that can help generate a more of a conducive environment for civil society actors.
And that would relate to your third recommendation then, I suppose, of involving both foreign policy and aid in particular. I would allow for questions that need clarification. We will have a more of a discussion later, but if there's any questions from the audience that you need a bit more clarity on, I'd take that. No. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Richard. It's really interesting, and thanks for making our world so much more complicated. That's probably good.